Welcome to the Music Room on WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark. Each week, WVUD hosts different artists to talk about the music they play and the lives they lead. Stay tuned for the Music Room on WVUD.
Hi, I'm Mando Richard. Tonight on the Music Room, we have an interview with Hélène Grimaud, recorded on October 25th of 2013. She's a French pianist who's currently performing the two Brahms piano concertos as she travels all over the world. I think you'll enjoy Hélène Grimaud's visit to the Music Room here on WVUD.
You were born in France, but seem drawn to Beethoven, Brahms, and other German and East European composers. Why is that?
Difficult to tell. You know, these questions relating to affinities, chemistry, inner resonances, it's always hard to be sure why those exist. I suppose it's like in relationships, it's utterly mysterious. In the case of Johannes Brahms, you know, I remember when I was first exposed to his music, and it was such a powerful experience. It was as if the music resonated so intimately within myself that I was finally in known and friendly territory, which I had not really found up until that point. And that feeling has only intensified, ever since, really.
I sort of get the sense that it might have to do with sort of an affinity you have with the Romantic movement, I mean, with a capital R, not sentimental.
Indeed, that's very true, except that, you know, when I was first exposed to that music, I didn't really know what that meant and what that movement stood for and that philosophy that was going to be, you know, very perceptive, so, you know, attractive to me later on. So there's still a part of mystery to all of this, I guess.
It's not strictly romantic music, but it ties in with sort of the rustic themes. One of my absolute favorites, well, two of my absolute favorites are Bartók and Kodály. And your 2011 CD, Resonances, includes Bartók's Romanian folk dances.
Yes.
So now, I'm a bassist, not a pianist, so you'll have to tell me, are they as much fun to play as they are to listen to?
That's so nice to hear. Yes, they are. They are incredibly fun to play. You know, there's something so primal, so raw about this folkloric expression. It's pretty much, you know, irresistible in the literal sense of the word. There's something that just grabs you by the hand, by the heart, and just takes you away. And that's very much the way these feel when you play them as well as when you hear them. And, you know, also something to do with the fragility of those, you know, shorter formats, so to say, you know, the smaller pieces, because you have to really pin down the just expression from the get-go. You know, you don't have much time to develop, to get into it. It has to be right from the very start, you know, with the color you produce within your, you know, your piano sound. That's so, so important. So they're also very intense at the same time.
Let's give a quick listen to you playing the sixth of those dances. This is Bartók's Romanian Folk Dance number 6 here on WVUD. Your latest recording for Deutsche Grammophon includes both Brahms piano concertos. They're really very different from each other.
Yes, they are. They're two different musical universes. At the same time, you know, the link is Brahms' life itself, and so it's I feel that the juxtaposition of both these concertos builds quite an illuminating bridge, you know, over his life. The first is such an intensely dramatic piece with this sense of urgency. It's very much about, you know, life's drama in the first degree, in the first person, and, you know, a little bit over two decades separate both concertos. And the second one is really more like a vast memoir almost, and it's constructed in great arches, not so much impetuous episodes like the first. And it's a piece which I find particularly poignant because it's really, I always get the feeling that Brahms is looking back at his life up until that point, not just the way that it has been, but the way that it could have been, the way that it could still be. And so it gives a very sort of complex but extremely sort of ambitious aspiration sort of dimension to the work.
Now, the first you say he wrote, he was
in his mid-20s.
Mid-20s, okay. My memory is it's got lots of, if you will, short themes and short responses between different parts of the orchestra and the piano.
Well, yes, but there's also something which was pretty much unknown up until that point, is the use of the piano almost as an integral part of the orchestra. Uh-huh. So, you know, the piano sound melts into that mass. And as a matter of fact, the concerto wasn't well received at all when it was first premiered, probably partly for that reason, because people couldn't even recognize the concerto form as they were, you know, used to it. So it was quite revolutionary. But, you know, as with any concerto, no matter how tremendous the overall architecture may be, which is the case for both these pieces, you know, both over 50 minutes long, is that they should still be done in the spirit of chamber music. That's how the music is really going to soar, you know, off the page and off the stage, is if everyone is playing as one living, breathing musical being.
And you'd recorded the first concerto before, I think, what, 14, 15 years ago?
Yes.
What was different about the whole experience this time?
From 14, 15 years ago, well, simply a decade and a half later to begin with, after, you know, years of living with this music, reconsidering it, dismantling it, it's something which is never ceases to amaze me, how these pieces live within you and continue to evolve within you, even when you're not actively engaged, you know, with them. It's something quite miraculous. Of course, the partners involved are a huge, you know, factor, a huge component in the equation of the final result too, because you react to everything you hear, and so of course, the orchestra, the maestro, all of this is going to have a huge influence on the direction that you know, such a recording can take. But somehow, you know, doing this first concerto live, this is so fitting because it so matches that urgency that we were talking about earlier in the piece. Somehow I can't really imagine doing that particular piece in a studio setting. I think it really needs that live performance feel to it. And it's, I mean, I feel very blessed to have been given the chance to record it twice with such great, you know, such great partners, and particularly this last time in combination with number two, you know, with Andres Nelsons. I mean, it's really a great source of joy. I mean, it was during the recording. It continues to be every time we meet and make music together again, and I have a lot of very beautiful things to look forward to because I have a lot of musical appointments with him in the upcoming season. So it's
with Andres Nelsons.
Nice. Yes, yes.
Now, you're playing both Brahms concertos a lot during your world tour during the 2013-2014 season. So let's turn to the second a little bit more, which you'll be playing with the Philadelphia Orchestra December 5th through the 8th of 2013. And
right.
Ellen, I have to confess that the second and third movements are two of my favorites from the entire classical or concert hall music catalog. What really?
Well, there are mine as well. I mean, I'm glad that we have the same. We share the same strength of feeling for these two movements because they are indeed absolutely sublime, both of them. And it's something so it's so difficult to explain the feelings that go through one when you are working on these and rehearsing them and performing them. They are just the epitome of what one would want from a scherzo in the case of the second movement and a slow movement. I mean, that's that one is just it makes time stop.
As emotionally wrenching as it can be for me and the audience to listen to, I must imagine that it's even more so for you performing.
It can be. You know, it's very interesting because discussing this point with colleagues, you know, they're the ones of us who I think you could say really live the music perhaps as emotionally as they would receive it if they were on the listening end. And then you have performers who are masterful in what they do and will have a different approach to that. I remember a French colleague particularly telling me that, you know, for him, no, absolutely not. He felt always very distanced and was simply aware of the emotional impact that certain harmonies can have, and that his job as an interpreter was to somehow emphasize those in a way that they would produce this emotional effect. So, and I remember at that moment thinking, well, it makes for two races of us, because as much as I absolutely admire and sometimes even envy this type of performer, it's not how I can, you know, live the music when I'm out there. So I would agree with what you said. It's, I think I think I can speak for the orchestra in the case of Vienna Phil in this recording, and for Andres Nilsson, definitely that they would agree with you as well in terms of you know, feeling that music through every cell of your being while you're making it. But it is true that you cannot always afford to lose yourself in it. I mean, you have this huge responsibility of carrying it across, and that is something that you should not lose sight of either.
That's right, because you are part of the relationship with the orchestra, too.
Exactly.
Now, in just a minute, we'll let the listeners hear the second movement from your playing of Brahms' Second Concerto. I really like the mixture of what I feel, power and emotion and tempo changes and drama. What else should the audience be listening for?
I think that pretty much covers it. I mean, you know what? I think what we get from hearing such works, I mean, and what I think lies at the heart of Brahms, you know, tremendous humanity and this and perhaps the highest aspiration of music itself. It's really to touch the heart of the listeners and to move them to dialoguing with themselves. I mean, I really feel that this is something which classical music accomplishes at least as well, if not better, than any other type of music, and that's making you feel more alive and making you able to access your full potential and looking at things not just the way they are, but the way that you know they could be, and enabling you to make that reality simply from having made you feel more. And it's something which, you know, hopefully happens here.
Let's listen then to Hélène Grimaud playing the second movement, marked Allegro Appassionato, from Brahms' Piano Concerto No. 2 in B-flat major, with Andres Nilsson and the Vienna Philharmonic. Thank you. And then switching gears, you're very active in conservation, having founded the Wolf Conservation Center in South Salem, New York. How did this connect with your life?
It's a very long story, but you know, as a kid, like so many kids, I wanted to be a veterinarian. I later on wanted to become a biologist. And that's probably what I would have done if I hadn't all of a sudden, before I even had the chance to choose that and realize what it meant, become a concert pianist. So it's, mind you, it's something that I wouldn't exchange for anything in the world, but I'm very thankful that I found a way to preserve this duality in my existence. Later on, I went into studying ethology, the science of behavior. But specifically, what was the trigger for founding the Wolf Conservation Center was actually an encounter with one animal in the early 90s in Florida, high-content wolf hybrid. She was so different from any domestic canine I had ever met, but there was something so intense about her, and it made me want to look into basically the cause of wolves. And what I discovered was that there was a lot of work to do, unfortunately, because of the huge discrepancy between what these animals are and what people perceive of them. And that's with, most things that people do not understand. They tend to fear them, and what they fear, they tend to want to destroy. So it was something very powerful. I felt as if it was, just as much of a mission, in a way, as music was for me already at the time, that there was a sense of responsibility. It wasn't only something I was passionate about. It was something that I felt I had to do something about. And, there would have been different ways of trying to find an incarnation for this interest, but it seemed that creating a 501c3, a nonprofit organization dedicated to environmental education and conservation, was, at least for me, the better way to try and make a difference in that field.
So at the Wolf Conservation Center, you are mostly running educational programs, or do you do some breeding for reintroduction to the wild as well?
Yeah, we do both. It's a twofold mission. That was sort of how I conceived of the place from the get-go, because as much as I've said it often, there is no long-term hope for conservation without education, because that's really, unfortunately, still to this day, human tolerance or the lack thereof, which is the biggest obstacle to recovery for these animals. So that's still absolutely primordial. But at the same time, to be directly involved with conservation and participating in a program such as the SSP, the Species Survival Plan, in which I'm proud to say we play quite a big role now at the Wolf Conservation Center, which is about, the captive holding and captive breeding of some of the most endangered species in the case of the red wolf, and subspecies of the gray wolf in the case of the Mexican wolf. Their captive breeding and reintroduction in parts of their original range, I mean, that is something absolutely fantastic. It doesn't really get much better than that for someone who's interested in conservation. It's, again, a huge responsibility, and it's a very wonderful program, run by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the American Zoological Association, and many zoos and animal preserves participate in this program. So these are the two main activities at the Wolf Center.
I was really surprised to see you talking about some of the technology you use at the Wolf Conservation Center.
Yes, it's something which we rely on daily, also for animal husbandry, which is such a huge part of what we do, of course.
These would be the web cameras?
Exactly, the webcams to monitor what these SSP animals do, because of course you see that's the point. I mean, these animals, being that at least some of them are destined to being released, it is really crucial for the success of their reintroduction that they do not become habituated to people. So you have these extremely precious, rare animals that you have to really care for on the highest possible level, but at the same time you don't want to be hands-on in any way, shape, or form that might endanger their ability to basically reintegrate successfully into a wild existence. And so these webcams play an essential role in monitoring their behaviors, their interactions, and, of course, their health. It's really amazing how much we've come to rely on those.
And you can do all that without tipping your hand to the wolves that there are people watching them.
That's right, and it's also important for our public, because, of course, when the public comes to the Wolf Center, they get to see our ambassadors. bridge of understanding and concern for their wild counterparts. But of course, for the very reason that we just discussed, access to the SSP wolves is not an option. And so this is something that helps them also, you know, connect to what that program means, how important it is, and what goes into it.
Let's turn back to your music. I'm really drawn to your 2012 CD Duo, that collaboration between you and cellist Saul Gabetta. It really sounds like you had a lot of fun working on it.
Yes, we did. There was something so spontaneous and energizing about that experience with Saul. You know, I mean, one of the great things is that in our profession, we are, of course, scheduled quite a long time in advance. And when you all of a sudden have the chance to experience something that wasn't planned, that you just could not foresee would turn out quite so well, it was just almost a chance encounter at the Gstaad Music Festival. And when the experience is so convincing and so strong that you wish to repeat it and in this case even leave a trace of it by doing a recording, it's really very much perceived as a gift. And I just loved that element of spontaneity and this desire to do something just for the sake of doing it without any particular agenda, and having something like this then turn into, you know, a beautiful recording experience with an artist like Saul. So that was indeed a lot of fun.
You mentioned earlier in our interview that when you do a concerto, you try to get some of that chamber music feel, but I think there's got to be something different in the musical conversation between you as a pianist and a cellist in a sonata, or you as a pianist and an orchestra in a concerto
right,
setting.
Because you have, of course, less intimacy, and you have so many, you know, musical partners to be potentially dealing with at one given time when you're working with an orchestra. But it's still, I still very much believe that it should be the same idea. You can't realize it in the same way. There are also other things which are necessary in a concerto, because the piano is clearly playing a different role. But still in the attitude of listening and reacting in the moment to what happens, I think it's good to do it in that spirit. But of course, when you're playing with just one or two partners, you can reach a different level of shared freedom. And of course, German music repertoire is some of the most beautiful, you know, repertoire ever to be written. So it's another point too.
I think that, don't they say that cello is the stringed instrument whose voice is the closest to a human voice?
Absolutely.
Now, the program consists of sonatas by Schumann, Brahms, Debussy, and Shostakovich. How the heck did you two choose that program?
Well, actually, you know, when we first met and just decided to sit down and make music together just for the sake of it, we happened to both be in the same festival, although not performing together, not scheduled to perform together. We were both doing solo performances around that week, but just physically being in the same space and having always, you know, heard of each other and heard each other as well directly, you know, from performances or radio broadcasts or previous recordings, we must have had a sense that it would work well and that something, you know, nice would happen. But we sat down and just played through some of the pieces that we both had in our repertoire at the time, because we had, you know, just a couple of hours to spend together. And when this session, this sort of private music making session, resulted in us scheduling concerts and this recording, it was already so late into the planning of the upcoming season that we were going to have basically no time to meet again and rehearse. And so we thought, okay, let's look at all of the pieces that we played through on that day, and then we composed that program from that you know, choice of pieces. What we liked about it is that, you know, this makes for such an eclectic program. There's such a beautiful variety of languages, and it's really like a journey through the cello piano repertoire. And so we liked that very much too.
Well, to close our interview, I'd like our audience to hear you and Saul play the last movement from the Shostakovich sonata. What should we alert them to listen for?
That's a good question. I would say, well, going back to the Bartok, some of the folkloric elements of those bits and pieces of melody, even when they were exposed in a more, shall we say, even possibly sarcastic sort of atmosphere. And of course, this wonderfully crazy central section where, you know, everything goes sort of haywire, but I think it's absolutely brilliant and a ton of fun to play as well. And the rhythmic vitality and vigor of that last movement, there's something very revitalizing about that rhythmical pulse that you get in that movement. So these are at least a few of the things.
Thank you so much, Ellen.
Thank you. I really enjoyed our conversation. All the best to you.
Why, thank you. And now, Ellen Grimaud, piano, and Saul Gambetta, cello. And the last movement, marked Allegro, from Dmitri Shostakovich's Sonata for Cello and Piano, Opus 40. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to The Music Room on WVUD. For more information about this and other episodes of The Music Room, including selections from the interviews and information about the music, visit us online at sites.udel.edu/TMR. That's sites, S-I-T-E-S, dot UDEL, U-D-E-L, dot E-D-U, slash T-M-R. Tune in next Tuesday at 6:30 p.m. for another episode of The Music Room on WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark.